My name is Dr. Chris Jenkins, and I am the CEO of the Orian Society and the host of the Snake Talk podcast, the podcast where you learn about nature's most feared, maligned, and persecuted animals. I invite you to listen to this conversation, and maybe you'll find that what you perceive as fear is actually rooted in a deep fascination. Welcome to the Snake Talk podcast. I am here with Dr. Jim Wellahan, and we are going to talk about diseases in wildlife, and specifically, we're going to talk about some interesting diseases in snakes. I've always been interested in this topic, whether we're talking about something like a chronic wasting disease in a deer or a disease that's specifically hitting snake species. Because there's so many animals in the wild where you see these kind of these enigmatic, if you will, declines or disappearances that we just can't explain. And I've always wondered if there's more of this going on in nature than we realize. As an example, living here in the Southeast, our king snakes, it just seems that king snakes have really just disappeared from a lot of areas. And it's a very hard thing to explain. Those places that they've disappeared from are places that you might think they would actually be. And then places where they still occur are places you think they may have disappeared from something else, say like habitat. And I'm not trying to say that is a wildlife disease issue, but it's those types of things that have always raised my interest and just made me think there are other things going out on with wildlife populations, with animals in captivity, besides just the very obvious things such as a housing development going in. So I'm interested about today's topic, and we have an absolute expert, one of the world's experts on wildlife diseases, and someone with an incredible amount of experience with disease in snakes. We've worked with Jim relative to our indigo snake captive breeding program and reintroduction of the animal back into the kind of the western third of its range where it's disappeared. And University of Florida is certainly one of the epicenters, the huge institutions of knowledge in this space. So really excited to have you here today, Jim. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
No problem. I like to always start out and have the guest introduce themselves because you know yourself a lot better than I do. So we'll dive into some of your past, but who are you today? Where are you sitting and what's your current position and what do you work on?
I am an associate professor at the University of Florida. I'm podcasting from home right now, but it's a thanks to the pandemic. And so I spend about a third of my time as a clinician seeing patients in the hospital at the University of Florida with a ZooMed service. I'm also the primary veterinarian for the Luby Bat Conservancy and for Santa Fe Teaching Zoo. And then the other 4 out of 6 weeks, we have the zoological medicine diagnostic lab at the University of Florida, where we do a lot of PCR-based diagnostics for all kinds of non-domestic animals. And I also am a faculty member with a clinical microbiology lab. I'm board certified in both zoological medicine and microbiology.
Great. Well, you wear a lot of hats. You did mention something that I would love to just take a quick aside and mention to our audience. You mentioned the Santa Fe Teaching Zoo. I've always thought that was an amazing institution. You know, this is a place that people can actually go to school to learn the craft of working at zoos. So any of our audience that ever had that dream of working at a zoo, I would encourage you to go check out this institution. Is that something you would?
It's a great program. Yeah, I think they do a wonderful job.
Yeah, no, I agree. So, so snakes are a very eccentric interest. If you're talking about the average American or the average person, you know, most people think that people are really into snakes. You know, maybe they're a little strange. Maybe you know, their head is on sideways. But for a lot of us, it's a very normal thing. And so I always like to hear from my guests how they originally got into snakes in particular. In your case, I know you have very broad interests in wildlife, but how was that? Were you a child that, you know, that had, you know, were, you know, birds on your shoulders and, you know, catching snakes in the backyard, or is that something that came on as an adult?
That was something that, well, so when I was little, we had a dog and a cat, and as soon as my little brother came along, he was allergic to about everything. So all of a sudden, anything with feathers and fur was not an option. You know, I guess the first with squamates, you know, I think I got an annul as a little kid and growing up in Maine. From there, when I was in college, we got a green iguana, and it kind of spiraled from there, you know.
So this started early on, but it partially thanks to your little brother and his allergies. So do you still keep animals?
Oh yeah, I've got we've got some emus running around the backyard. Wife used to be a shelter vet, so we have a ball python and a corn snake from that. I actually breed some rubber boas. We have some tortoises running around outside. There's a non-releasable red-shouldered hawk with a traumatic brain injury. I have it on an education permit, and we have some cats. So
that's great. And rubber boas are amazing animals, as you know. You see them every day. I lived in rubber boa country for quite a while. I did my PhD in Idaho, and you know, we were actually working on rubber boas out of the lab, and I'm assuming some of your rubber boas may have originated through that. There was a whole group that kind of made it out from there.
Yeah, to be honest, I got one of them was a gift from a friend who had had it for a long time. I had a couple others that I picked up at a show here in Florida, like long time ago, like more than 20 years ago. And so it's kind of all before. Yeah. And they've successfully bred and they really aren't around anymore, you know, as far as something that you commonly see. They kind of all predate, you know, my being aware of what was going on with anything, you know.
Well, they are great animals. So you grew up, you know, with animals all around you. It sounds like you grew up with lizards. You're currently keeping a lot of animals. And so how did that translate into, you know, a career where you were thinking, I want to work with animals? Is that something you always knew, or is that something you kind of figured out when you went to college?
When I was an undergrad, I was really interested in molecular biology. I wanted to, you know, go work in RNA editing and all kinds of stuff. In the senior year, I got mono and kind of got taken out of things for a bit, missed GREs. So I decided to take a year off and go do GREs and apply the next year. While I was taking that year and working in a lab, I started volunteering with a veterinary clinic and really liked it. Yeah, it was, so that was kind of where it went from there.
So where you said you grew up in Maine when we were talking earlier, is that where you went to school as well? Did you go to Orono?
University I went to Bowdoin in Brunswick. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Great. Yeah. And so, so you're, You're in Bowdoin, and you ended up getting what? Did you say a microbiology degree?
I have a Bachelor of Arts in biochemistry because they don't give out a BS. Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah. And then you get sick, and you end up, but ultimately you end up working in this vet lab. And is that also in Brunswick area up in Maine?
That was right on the Vermont, New Hampshire. I was actually living in Norwich, Vermont, and working in Hanover, New Hampshire at Dartmouth. So,
Great. Okay. We do, Orien does a fair amount of work up in the Northeast, just not too far from there. We actually do a lot of work on the watershed, that Norwich is part of. I have staff members up there. We work mainly on freshwater turtles up there.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. It's a great area. I grew up in New England as well. So,
where are you from? Yeah.
I grew up in Massachusetts, not too far, kind of where Vermont, New Hampshire, and Massachusetts all come together.
Okay, so, cool.
Yeah. But so you're at Bowdoin, you end up going off and working in this vet lab. What type of work were you doing there? Were you getting a lot of hands-on experience with animals, or was it
The lab was a human. The lab was not veterinary. I did volunteer on the side at a veterinary clinic while I was working in the lab. Human toxoplasma research lab. It's toxoplasma is a protozoal disease. It's known as the reason pregnant women shouldn't change kitty litter boxes. And it's a major HIV secondary problem. So that was the main center and focus of the lab.
Oh, okay. So you're at this vet clinic over near Dartmouth then. And I'm assuming this is your first opportunity to really get a lot of real hands-on experience with animals in that type of like clinical type setting.
In a clinical setting for sure, yeah.
That accurate? Yeah. And was it diverse? I mean, was it just cats and dogs, or were you?
It was a, you know, practice in a small town it was on the Vermont side of things. So there, you know, they saw other things, but it was definitely not exotics oriented by any means. No, the bulk of the caseload was dogs and cats.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. We, and as you probably know, up in that New England area, the snake fungal disease has been quite an issue for some of those populations, and we may touch on that later as we get to diseases specifically.
We did some of the early work on the timber rattlesnake population up there and identifying ephidamyces.
Great. So you're up in New England, you're working in this lab, and you're volunteering in the vet clinic and getting all this hands-on experience with animals. Is that what made you decide, you know, I want to kind of bring these two interests, my interests in say biochemistry, microbiology, that arena, and with the clinical work on animals, was it that work at the vet clinic that kind of moved that forward? And how did you decide to take your next steps, and what were those?
So from there, I decided I should, it was definitely the combination of tying together the biology interests and the clinical interests. But from there, I went down to vet schools are very, there are different standards for getting in-state and out-of-state. And being from Maine, there was no vet school there, and there wasn't any in New Hampshire or Vermont either. So I went down to Massachusetts and worked as a zookeeper for a little bit after that at the what was the New England Science Center. Now it's the Ecotarium in Worcester. And started looking around at where I wanted to go. At the time, Tufts had, I think, the highest tuition of any vet school, and my roommates, who were vet students at the time, convinced me I should go somewhere else and not run up a bunch of debt. So I looked around at other places, and Minnesota had if you lived there for a year, you could get in-state consideration. And so I applied to a graduate program out at the University of Minnesota, and went out there, did a master's degree looking at mycoplasma and house finches, and went to vet school. And then from there, I went to Guelph University, the vet school in Ontario, and did an internship in avian exotic medicine there. And then went to Florida and did my residency and PhD. So
excellent. So as a little aside, so being a veterinarian of any type, is, you know, I think there are certain jobs in this world that, you know, there are huge numbers of people that would be very excited. You know, I would classify myself, I'm a herpetologist, but I'm a wildlife biologist, is how I'd classify myself. And that is certainly one of these groups I'm talking about, maybe an anthropologist. But there are certain jobs that that people look at, and there'll be a large number of people that want to do them because of the lifestyle, because of certain aspects of it. But those groups get whittled down to a relatively small proportion that actually make it. So just being someone, you know, it sounds like you really went through a very comprehensive kind of lead up to your current position today, getting multiple graduate degrees, going to vet school, you know, combining clinical work that you did with dogs and cats and your expertise in biochemistry. Like, what would be your best advice for somebody who's listened to this podcast, who dreams about being a veterinarian? I know it can be very hard, for example, to get into vet school. Just as an aside, do you have any just general advice that you would give people?
Well, it's, you know, I would become aware of what the requirements and things like that are. The, you know, admissions at all the colleges of veterinary medicine will provide you things like, you know, what is the average GPA for incoming classes? What is the, you know, all of the various data. And unfortunately, a whole bunch of it is you know, here's a set of numbers, let's crunch them all. And then there's only a very small subset in the middle that are that get looked at, you know, more discriminately there to kind of figure out where the edge sits. Yeah, be aware of what's going on, with requirements for veterinary school. All of those are available, you know, from them. And get in there and get time and experience with practice. And then, you know, a lot of the class is not necessarily admitted on their first time through. So it's not necessarily, you know, a one time thing. I mean, I quite frankly, I don't think if I hadn't done my master's degree, I partied a lot in undergrad and, you know, needed to get my GPA higher and needed to get some more experience and things like that. And honestly, I mean, you know, there were people in my class who were like, boom, 4.0 from, you know, and I did great in veterinary school, but before that, you know, for admissions for every class, they kind of give, you know, here's the range of GREs and here's the range of GPA. And, I graduated from vet school with a 3.98, but when I went in, I had the lowest GPA in my entering class, because I had, you know, not focused on things, and I barely skimmed in. I'm glad I made it over that hurdle, because you know, I you know, graduated pretty much near the top of my graduating class. But entering, I was 28 by the time I started vet school, and you know, I'm glad I had the experience and all the other things, because I don't think I'd be doing what I did now if I just blasted through and did that. But it's, you know, in some ways I wish I'd focused a little more too earlier.
Yeah. That's kind of how I was too. When I found what I wanted to, you know, what I wanted to do, you know, my grades, my performance, everything was just top. But before that, you know, we may have even been at a party or two together.
Yeah.
You
know, it's possible. There's a few I don't remember.
but anyways, well, I appreciate that aside. So you end up, you're at University of Florida and you do your PhD there as well. And then did you say it was a residency?
Yeah. So, in human medicine, the internships and residencies are usually all one program. But we have, in veterinary medicine, usually you do an internship at one place and then a residency, somewhere else following that. And it's not, you know, human medicine, you pretty much have to do a residency. You're not going to be able to go into practice and get insurance, you know, if you're not boarded as a specialist. In veterinary medicine, only a subset of the class is going on to do specialty. sorts of things. And in ZoomEd, like match day was actually yesterday for our new incoming resident is going to be Dr. Molly Horgan, who actually happens to be our current intern. She's great. And so we match, you know, we do that once a year, but that's another bottleneck that is a significant hurdle to get through. We had about 80 something applicants for the position. So, you know, it people who have a lot of experience, with that, people who are, you know, high up in their class and you know, we also want someone who's fun to work with too. If someone's a royal pain in the butt, then we don't want that either. but we do have, you know, where it is one person, we can, rather than a class of 120, we can spend a lot more time kind of getting to know people a little better too and do some interviews. So.
Yeah. So you're obviously sitting today, you're an associate professor at University of Florida and you did your residency there. So is it typical that if you do a residency at a particular entity, that a residency is kind of the first step to getting a job, or would it be, is that kind of something uncommon that you're still at University of Florida? It would have been more normal that you did your residency at University of Florida and then you end up at, you know, some zoo in California or whatever it might be.
For example, for our current faculty or myself, and Dr. Amy Alexander, who did she did vet school at UF, but then she went off and did a couple of internships other places and did her residency at St. Louis Zoo, worked at the San Francisco Zoo for a little bit, and then came back and took a faculty position at UF. Dr. Daryl Hurd is the service chief, and he actually went to vet school in Australia. Came over here, did an anesthesia residency first, and then did a zoo residency and a PhD, and has stuck around. And was one of the people who instructed me while I was a resident. So there we have, you know, kept a couple of our own for sure, but it's not necessarily, you know, in an academic position where you have the thing that attracted me really to that was the resources for doing research. I kind of feel like I want to leave the profession better than when I found it. It is generally helpful in order to have a residency, you have to have at least two board certified zoo medicine specialists for a zoological medicine residency. So. Most academic teaching positions require residency trained people to do that.
Okay, great. So just to kind of finish up the trajectory of your career, what was the process of, you know, how did you get from your residency at University of Florida to being, you know, a faculty member there?
When I was a resident, I was kind of finishing up and was working at Animal Kingdom for a little bit. A good friend of mine who'd been doing his PhD while I was doing a residency, the Navy had, was right about the time we were invading Iraq, and a bunch of our, the Navy dolphins were sick and they didn't know why. So I'd done a couple of things that were, you know, for identifying some novel viruses and kind of showed we could do that pretty well. And Hendrik had done his PhD on marine mammal pox viruses. And so they approached us and said, hey, if we give you $5 million, will you go figure out what these viruses are and what they mean? And we're like, yeah, we can do that. So we had a grant from the Office of Naval Research to go figure out what that was. And that, universities run off of indirect costs and grants. And so I did my PhD off of that grant. And we did that for a few years until I knew that there was a Elliot Jacobson, one of the faculty members at the time in ZoomEd was planning to retire in 2012. So I figured I would you know, this was a good thing to do for the interim. And I know I liked academics, and the University of Florida has a caseload that is pretty much not replicated anywhere else as far as, you know, being able to see some pretty diverse and pretty weird stuff. You know,
emus and all kinds of. I would think you've probably between Florida and Texas, you probably those are probably the states that have the most interesting suite of animals.
Yeah, they are, and I would have to say that I also feel really lucky, and that I really like the people I work with. They're a great bunch of folks, and I feel lucky to have them. Not only are they highly competent, but they're also fun, you know, and people I enjoy as friends, and so that, you know, was made it a pretty easy decision.
Yeah. Do you enjoy Florida, or do you miss Maine, or?
There are plus, I miss mountains. I definitely miss mountains. And you know, I like snow, but I like being able to keep my tortoises outside most of the year. So there's pluses, minuses to everything. Florida politics, I could take a pass on, but
we won't go into politics. Well, let's shift gears a little bit, and I want to talk about I say wildlife disease, but let me just say animal diseases, because especially, I guess it's not especially, but there are a lot of reptiles that are kept in captivity, and the diseases in captivity versus the wild, and you know, some of the issues across those barriers are huge and interesting to me. But I just want to start off by saying, again, I'm making generalities about people in society, but I think oftentimes people, the way humans view diseases, whether it's a human disease or it's a animal disease, is that they think of it as this thing, whatever it might be, that is like just, it's just kind of a one way thing. It's something that's there to hurt people. It's something there to hurt animals. And I've always, while I'm not an expert, as you are, I've taken biochemistry, but while I'm not well versed in biochemistry, I think of these things oftentimes as living. You know, it might be, fungi, or it might be, viruses or bacteria, but they're these things, either living or not. And they have an ecology, and they have a way that they function in the world. and that has huge impacts for what most people think of as that very directed, disease impacting people, whatever it might be. And by understanding the ecology and the biology, again, if it's living, of these things, it's just could be very helpful and interesting science in general. So anyways, I just wanted to say that that's kind of how I've always thought of it while not being an expert.
I would argue that ecologists generally have a better outlook on infectious diseases than most MDs do, because it is ecology. Absolutely. One of the ways, unfortunately, if you look back in infectious disease, way back in the day, Pasteur first figured out that these cows who were dying all of a sudden had, he could pull something out of their blood and grow it on a plate, and that was anthrax. And he put it back into new cows, and they died. But he initially also figured out that if he mixed it with other bacteria that were present in the soil and stuck it back into cows, less of them died. And he was already figuring out it was a complex thing. But then Lister and Koch and the Germans got a hold of it. And they came up with Koch's postulates, or something that are taught in medical and veterinary school. And it's like, in order to show something is a pathogen, you have to isolate it out of cases of disease, reinfect new animals with it, and be able to re-isolate it out afterwards and reliably cause the disease. And that paints infectious diseases black and white. And if ever there was an academic ivory tower bullshit way of looking at it, that's it. That doesn't apply in the real world, because disease is never as simple as there are some really good case series of asymptomatic Ebola virus infections in people. There are people who have died of Lactobacillus acidophilus septicemia, which is the good thing in your yogurt that you take for healthy stuff. It's all about context and what's going on in an animal. And we are incredibly complex ecosystems. Most of the cells in your body or a snake's body are not eukaryotic vertebrate cells. They're bacteria, you know, and there's a gazillion different bacteriophages and viruses living in there. And it's all about context.
Hey, everybody, I just wanted to take a quick break and tell you guys that reptiles are declining around the world. As an example, turtles are the most threatened group of animals on the planet, with over 60% of all species classified as endangered. The Oriane Society works every day to ensure that there's a future for these amazing animals. If you care about reptiles, amphibians, and their habitats, become a member of the Oriane Society today by visiting www.oriane.org.
Yeah, fascinating. So, where do I want to go with that? Let's start with the word disease. Okay. So you and I both use words like bacteria, virus, fungi, whatever it might be, living things, non-living things. How do you define what a disease is, an animal disease?
Well, it's something that, looking at it from an organismal level, is causing impairment of organismal function, you know, and for infectious diseases, you know, the more I look at infectious disease, the more I realize that more and more of them are co-infection and things like that. I see a lot of leopard geckos who have Ublepharid adenovirus 1, which is a leopard gecko adenovirus. Some of them who are sick and some of them who are doing well. I see a lot of leopard geckos who have Cryptosporidium varani, some of whom are sick and some of whom are doing well. I have never seen one who has both and is anything but wasting away and dying. You know, and our understanding of how all these things fit together, we often get, hey, it's got this thing here that is a pathogen, you know, and we stop there and we stop thinking, you know, and it's so, you know, and with reptiles, it's kind of wonderful because we have this whole other dimension. You know, if I've got a dog with canine distemper, which is a morbillivirus, you know, a paramyxovirus, I am kind of stuck with having that dog at about 100 degrees Fahrenheit. You know, and I can't really change its temperature that much. So I am, you know, stuck with other things to mess with virus, and I don't have a lot of good options. And the dog will get a fever to try and overcome stuff, but it can't move that much. If I've got a snake with a paramyxovirus, I can totally change the temperature of the snake is at. And from a clinical disease standpoint, you can often get marked improvement in animals doing things you just can't do in a animal that doesn't have that thermal flexibility.
Interesting. Yeah, I remember actually in graduate school taking environmental physiology, we learned a lot about snakes and just like behavioral fever, we would call it, where snakes, you know, they control their temperature. But that's interesting taking that into the clinic where you can use temperature, as a treatment. Well, I guess I don't know if that's the right word. I guess it is a treatment. Yeah. You'd raise the snake's body temperature and let its body, say, fight whatever it's infected with. So disease, in the example you gave, it was, I think, a virus and a fungus. Those
the protozoan.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So the two of those combined in that example, those would be the disease. It's not, you know, one in and of itself. They could be a disease in and of themselves. I'm just trying to get a way to think about disease.
Beyond that, it's the, you know, whatever was missing nutritionally in that animal's diet and, you know, whatever was off, you know, temperature wise that this animal couldn't reach optimal temperatures and whatever was, and the cat sitting outside the tank staring at it and stressing the crap out of it. All of those things come together to play a role in disease. And it is really uncommon in captive animal medicine to see disease where husbandry has not played a very significant role.
Ah, okay. Well, interesting. I like that as a framework. That's helped me a lot for the way I think about the word of disease. So we talked a little bit about ecology of the disease. And you mentioned that a lot of ecologists probably even at least conceptually think about some of these disease issues in a better way than maybe even a lot of medical doctors. Are there, just out of curiosity, as kind of an aside, are there a lot of medical doctors in the human field that are starting to think like that? Is that progressing? Less kind of cause and effect and thinking.
There are some, but they generally tend to be specialists. Another thing we run into, is the whole One Health approach, where people are trying to work together and understand that. And I think that's very helpful. Unfortunately, a subset of the MDs you run into that are looking for infectious diseases of humans and infectious diseases of humans in other unimportant species is how they look at it. But there are some people out there doing some very good work.
Yeah.
It's just unfortunately something that, if you're going to go and, work in a non-infectious, human medicine is so specialized that, if you look at pathologists, human pathologists don't look at everything. There are human pathologists who look at glomeruli in a kidney and human pathologists who look at tubules in a kidney, and they don't overlap. There's a lot of hyper specialization, and that makes it difficult to get the big picture.
Gotcha. And I'm assuming you have the same general issue in the vet world, in terms of thinking about diseases where a large proportion of veterinarians don't think in that, from that ecological mindset. It's just treating an animal versus a human, and they just kind of have this cause and effect type. How do I solve this problem right now?
Well, absolutely. I mean, one of the major challenges we run into is if you're looking at your patient as a collection of vertebrate cells, you're going to miss a whole bunch of the picture, because our gut flora influences everything from endocrine to immune responses to obesity to all kinds of things that are going on there. So the whole concept of, I'll just throw some antibiotic, it's not going to do any harm. So there are studies in humans where they take humans, and ciprofloxacin is a pretty well-known antibiotic I think a lot of people have heard of, right? And so they take volunteer humans who have been, and this study's been replicated more than once, and they give some of them ciprofloxacin and some of them get a placebo. And then they give them 3 days for a washout period. And then they challenge them with salmonella. And the amount of salmonella it takes to move in and cause disease in the people who have recently been treated with antibiotics, which devastates their gut flora, is about 1% of the amount of salmonella. Because you have this nice, healthy ecosystem, with mature ecosystem in a gut that has things in there that are occupying their niche and doesn't let this invasive species, salmonella, move in and start taking over. Or you have what's essentially happened in the gut is like a forest fire, there's just been massive, depopulation of everything in there. And it's a great opportunity for invasive species to come in and establish and take hold. So we're reaching a point with sticking with bacteriology, we're reaching a point where, when penicillin came out, that was a major breakthrough. And all of a sudden people's lifespans went way up. But it's not uncommon to see, Staph aureus is the common human thing, skin flora. We've been seeing methicillin resistant Staph aureus, MRSA, which I think a lot of people have heard of and are relatively intimidated by, because it's getting to the point where we don't have antibiotics to successfully treat these anymore. When we look at, the sort of equivalent in dogs and cats is there's a Staph pseudintermedius is the most common skin flora in dogs and cats that's sort of like that. When we look at the Staph pseudintermedius isolates that are coming through the University of Florida, a good rule of thumb that you want to have to make just picking an antibiotic as a reasonable choice to treat something is that about 70% of the isolates you see are going to be susceptible to it. So when we look at antibiotics that at least 70% of the staph pseudointermediates from dogs and cats, common skin flora on them, are susceptible to, the only two left, you know, that we're seeing, they're resistant to all of the commonly used antibiotics. The only two left are chloramphenicol, which is a drug that causes aplastic anemia and kills about 1 in 10,000 humans. So everyone stays away from that because they're afraid of killing a person. And rifampin, which is a drug that is commonly used in combination therapy with tuberculosis. But it's not commonly used as a solo drug at all. It tends to be very hepatotoxic, and it really makes you feel kind of sick. So no one's used that. So the only two antibiotics that the most common skin flora we're seeing at UF now are resistant to everything except for a couple of, you know, difficult choices. And we have no antibiotics to treat anymore. And that's becoming a bigger and bigger problem. So if you just throw antibiotics at something and thinking it's not causing any harm, we're almost done with antibiotics. From a drug development standpoint, if you're a pharmaceutical company and it costs you $1 billion or more to get a drug on the market, you can either go and develop, you know, a balding pill, which people will take and continue taking for the rest of their life, or you can develop an antibiotic, which people will take for 2 weeks and then hopefully stop and never take again. And 10 years from now, it's not going to work as well as it did. So from a corporate standpoint, pharmaceutical companies, you know, it doesn't make any sense to develop antibiotics. So they don't. The last major pharmaceutical company to shut down its antibiotic development program was Pfizer more than 10 years ago, and they're not doing it. It doesn't make economic sense to develop new antibiotics because you can spend that money developing, you know, some drug that people are going to take for the rest of their life that may not be as relevant. And we're in deep trouble from an antibiotic standpoint.
And our behavior is part of, seems to me, we're speeding up that process of making these ineffective. But anyways, we can do a whole podcast on that.
Yeah. as a tangent, I do think one of the things we need to figure out is, rather than what's in here, thinking of it as what's the problem, what we should be thinking of is what's a healthy ecosystem. And how can we start creating that? And we don't even have a good answer to what the diversity of these things should be. You can't look at a rainforest that's just burned down and said, well, usually they have spider monkeys. I'm going to go let some spider monkeys loose here and expect that to go well. You know, you need more than just spider monkeys to create a rainforest. And so it's, you know, and the exact same thing is happening in a snake. Snake gut ecology is cool because they really upregulate everything after, you know, when you look at what happens after a snake eats, it totally changes. Even at a phylum level with bacteria, the all of a sudden you see these a lot more. There's a major turnover even on a phylum level of what's present and what's dominant after food versus not. It's a very flexible system.
How do they, staying on that tangent, because it just sounds horribly interesting, how do they flip those switches? Is that a temperature thing where they allow, say, one bacteria to be more active and proliferate, or how do they flip that switch?
My guess, and this is not, you know, not solid database, but is that the presence of food creates you know, things for these bacteria to feed on, and so that's changing. Mm-hmm. But you look at like the villi in the intestines on a snake, right? After they eat, they get more than tenfold longer. The oxygen consumption rate in a python after it eats goes up 40-fold. We can't do that. I mean, if you go for a run, you can maybe double your oxygen consumption rate. Yeah, but the whole thought of just shutting everything down, you know, we're sitting here burning a pile of energy on these incredibly expensive loops of Henle in our kidneys. Mammal kidneys are a terrible design. Reptile kidneys are a much better way to do it. And then we're sitting here burning energy on heat all the time. So you're kind of, you know, foot is on the accelerator all the time. Snakes can, if they're not digesting, they can totally just become quiescent. The mass of the muscle of the heart more than doubles after they eat and then goes back down again, which is, you know, they really like gear up and then just trim down again to stop wasting energy in between. They're much more efficient.
Yeah. Eating is a big event. And like you said, certainly much more efficient than mammals overall and humans, definitely. So it sounds like a lot of your graduate work was with birds. I can see some raptor sitting on behind you and cats walking around. And, you know, I know you have rubber boas in the next room and you've worked on all these animals. So what I'm getting at is you are not necessarily a snake specific expert. You work across all these taxonomic groups. And so when we think about wildlife disease, we don't need to go into too much depth, but I'm just curious how different wildlife disease is based on taxonomy. Do most diseases kind of work across these taxonomies, say from birds to reptiles to amphibians, or are they really typically very distinct, or do we see everything in between?
Yeah, there's a whole range. It's just like animals. You know, you have some animals who are, you know, a queen snake, you need to have, you know, crayfish to feed it, or you're going to be in trouble. Whereas there's other, you know, you can feed an indigo about anything and it'll, and so do you have a generalist or a specialist? And that applies to infectious diseases too, you know, to all these microbes. And so where does this ecological context fit? And that's one of the things I really like about virology actually, is that, you know, if I look at, cause I love comparative evolution and ecology. And so if you look at a herpes virus, I can look at the relationship of the herpes viruses, and within the alpha herpes viruses, you know, the first ones to branch off infect squamates. The next ones to branch off infect turtles. The next ones, we've just got the first crocodilian ones. It looks like they're, you know, the archosaurs, the crocodilians and the dinosaurs definitely are clade there. And then right in the middle of the alpha herpes viruses is the one host jump, because all the beta and gamma herpes viruses are mammals, right? But the one major host jump in there is from the alpha herpes viruses. It looked like it jumped from an archosaur into a mammal. And so that's where, you know, chicken pox, which is human herpes virus 3, may be a more accurate name than anybody actually knew, because it may have actually come from a and I can look at that. And so that's 300 million years of evolution that I can follow this code divergence, you know, of the herpes viruses over. Where on the other hand, if I want to look at, you know, some of the little zippy aren't, and that's a, herpes are big complex viruses with dozens of genes, and they're, you know, they use all the host mechanisms for stay. They're very stable, you know, and there haven't been many major host jumps, you know, over the course of the whole thing. Whereas if you look at like a little Khaleesi virus, you know, we did a study where we took a swab out of the nose of a sea lion and passaged it five times in culture and looked at the diversity after five passages in culture versus the passage in a nose versus just what was originally in the nose. And, you know, some amino acids had gone in prevalence, some amino acids that were coded for had gone in for prevalence from 1% to 100% after five passages in culture. And, you know, you can, you know, wait a week and you've got a new RNA virus, you know, and so this whole big contrast in scale and ecology and specificity is fascinating, and then there's so many useful things in there.
Do most zoo med professionals then focus taxonomically, or do they focus more, like, say, on, you know, say viruses, or you know, or are they more typically generalists? Like, it sounds like you have real expertise across both taxonomy, across different types of diseases. How do people in your field typically specialize?
Well, I always say that zoo medicine is the ultimate unspecialty. You know, I mean, people will have a focus, like, you know, Daryl Hurd is very interested in anesthesia. So he's written the textbook on zoo anesthesia, so he kind of I find the most interesting things are at the intersection of fields. My interests are definitely in microbiology and comparative and in a lot of ways you can kind of, you know, at what point does something turn from a, you know, there are viruses of bacteria, you know, at with ticks, we're usually thinking of them as the disease, and with spiders, we're usually thinking of them as the host, you know, but we're in arthropods. You know, some arthropods are animals I'm trying to treat, and some arthropods are diseases we're trying to get rid of. You know, and so and that's a very subjective call. You know,
Well, let's talk about snakes specifically. So, I'd like to have you just speak for a little bit on the word snake disease, and how would you characterize that to our audience? I guess in a fairly general sense. I think we will talk specifically about some diseases, but you know, are there, for example, are there many diseases that are specific to snakes? Are they affected, you know, widely to some of these more generalist type diseases? Do viruses have more impact on snakes, more common? Whatever it might be, are there a lot of snake diseases? Do we understand them well, or is it an unknown field? Just how would you classify the whole field of snake disease?
We're rapidly expanding in our understanding of all of it. Even in human medicine, the tools we've got now, you know, once upon a time we used to be dependent upon being able to grow something, you know, and you know, when you look at even, we're relatively good at culturing bacteria, right, compared to viruses or, you know, some of the protozoa. But even in bacteria, the number that we can actually culture is very minimal. I mean, if you look at the human gingival sulcus, that little groove up next to between your tooth and gum, you can culture about 70 different species out of there. But using molecular techniques to say how many species are there, it turns out there's about normally 700 bacterial species, and we're able to culture about 10% of those. That's better than most ecological niches. We're usually culturing about 1-2% for most ecological niches. So, you know, bacterial cultures are a very lossy way of doing things. But if you just look at bacteria, so with the development of some of these nucleic acid-based tools where, you know, I mean, life is essentially centered around DNA and for some viruses, RNA. Having, you know, first PCR ability where you needed to know, you know, just a little bit of sequence, and then you could grab the new stuff in between. So, you know, when we first started doing this, we identified a bunch of adenoviruses in snakes and really found that they were causing some serious problems in some of the Lampropeltids and Pitchophis, for example. But to find those, we just basically lined up a whole bunch of other adenoviruses and said, hey, look, these little areas right here seem to be conserved and staying the same. And then I could use those areas to make PCR primers and get the bits in between them and sequence that and see what I got. And that was great because then all of a sudden we could get things that we couldn't culture. And most adenoviruses have not successfully been cultured. For a virus, they're not even particularly difficult. So we started being able to look at the diversity of that. And since then, we've even got some new tools like a MiSeq or some of the next generation sequencers, where you can take just a bunch of DNA, shear it up into little different sized bits, throw it on a little chip where it goes into, you know, like you can get about 30 million little parts of that out and get 30 million sequences and see what's in there. And that's useful for when you have no idea what the heck something is. Like when we looked at sunshine virus, or we've got a new encephalitis virus out of rattlesnakes, it doesn't look anything like any other known virus. We could put things together, you know, you take all these 30 million little parts, see where some of them overlap and assemble them and try and figure out what's snake and what's snake bacteria and what might be a virus. And it's, you know, that's the hard part, the bioinformatics and figuring out how all this fits together and interpreting 30 million sequences you've got back. You know, we now have tools to find totally new things. And so it's such a massive expansion in a short period of time on what we know is out there.
So this is the time we've been increasing our understanding of snake disease. Almost sounds like exponentially. At least we're at that point where it is increasing very quickly now. Based
when,
on
when I look at what we knew about 10 years, when I look about what we knew about 10 years ago, and what we know about now, you know, it's gone up an order of magnitude.
So again, in a general sense, what do we know? You mentioned the idea that they're ectotherms, or people like the term. I don't like it so much, but people understand the concept of the term cold-blooded. But as ectotherms, you know, that their ability to deal with certain diseases. But are there certain types of diseases, whether it be like a virus or some of the bacteria, that are more common in snakes, say, relative to other taxonomic groups? Are there other things that are kind of exceptional about snake disease? Maybe snakes get fewer diseases than mammals. I don't know what it might be. I'm just curious how you might characterize snake disease, or does it follow along with other groups people think about?
I think one of the challenges that you run into is that when you look at the ecology of the whole thing, right? So host density is you know, from a microbe standpoint, your goals are to find some place to live and continue to move on, because one of the challenges of vertebrates is they have a limited lifespan. So you have to get into a vertebrate, you have to live there successfully, out competing all the other native flora, not getting taken out by the immune system, and then find a way to get into a new host. You know, things like you know, sneezing or coughing or diarrhea or things like that are a great way to get from one host to another. So sometimes that's positively selected for, and it really depends on the, you know, some things have a very explosive sort of ecology where you can kind of move in, and you know, like a paramyxovirus kind of comes through, replicates like crazy, and move on to a new host. And that's a perfectly viable strategy, provided you have sufficient host density. Like the human paramyx, best known human paramyxovirus is measles. That probably only became, you know, one. So there's two ways we can get rid of measles. One, you can just use the vaccine and don't believe Jenny McCarthy, and we could vaccinate people and we get rid of it. Another way you can get rid of it is if the human population ever drops below about 500,000 people, there won't be enough naive people to keep getting infected with it, and it just kind of blasts through and moves on. So, you know, dropping the human population below 500,000 people is probably a little brutal. But this is really only something that moved into our population when we started living in larger groups, where we had a continuous communicating population of more than 500,000 people. It happened sometime around the year 1100, it looks like. And we picked that up from rinderpest and cattle, who were living in, you know, large herds and things like that. One of the challenges is the way that snakes are commonly kept. You know, their stocking density is huge, and that is a massive selection factor for virulence. If your snake density isn't very high and you're very pathogenic, and you move to, you kill off that host, then all of a sudden that host just sits there and rots, and it's a dead end for that pathogen. Now, if the host density is screamingly high, it's perfectly fine to be virulent, because you're going to get fed a new snake. So one of the challenges is the way that snakes are commonly kept is with a very high stocking density. I mean, you look at cattle, for example. You know, if you have cattle out free ranging in a pasture, That's one thing. But if you put cattle in a feedlot where they're all sitting on top of each other, and then feed them corn, you know, where the pH of their rumen, when they have that much of a carbo load, is going to be screamingly acidic, and they're all going to have rumen ulcers. If you don't give those cattle antibiotics, they're going to die. And so we do. And that's a short-term viable, economically advantageous, but long-term, it's incredibly stupid. And so we need to look at how we're housing these things. And so I think, unfortunately, what we've done is taken animals from all over the world, mixed them all together, and they all have their own flora that they've been evolving with. And so, for example, you know, when we look at the Burmese pythons in the Everglades, there's a lung parasite called a Rallatella orientalis. It's a penostomid worm. And Burmese pythons don't have a big problem with it. It hangs out in their lungs. lays eggs. They cough up the eggs, swallow them, poop them out. Some sort of intermediate host, a rodent or something like that, will eat it. And then the another Burmese python comes along and eats it and gets infected with a larva. And that's not a big deal for a Burmese python, but we let them glow in the Everglades. And it turns out that when pygmy rattlesnakes get it and they've got a worm this big in their lung, then that's a major problem and it plugs up their trachea. You know, our lungs are like a trachea and then smaller bronchi and smaller bronchioles and alveoli. Snake lungs are just like trachea, boom, open up into this big chamber of a lung. And so something big going forward just plugs up that trachea and that's the end of the snake. And so we're seeing crashes in pygmy rattlesnake populations due to Rattlesnake orientalis, which is a parasite that's been introduced with Burmese pythons. So this mixing of species from all over the place and high stocking densities, which are a couple of things that are pretty common in captive animals, are significantly increasing disease prevalence.
Would you say that, you know, so you mentioned captive and then you mentioned, you know, captive animals going into the wild with these diseases that then are having these indirect effects on other species. So would you say that many snake diseases are, you know, have their origins in captivity, or is it just these high stocking rates that you're more likely to see in captivity than the wild, you know, make it seem like that?
It's hard to say, because the surveillance is, you know, unfortunately there's a lot more money dumped into, you know, looking at white-tailed deer diseases than there are dumped into looking at wild rough green snake diseases. But this mixing of species from all over the world and the high stocking densities are going to be selecting for these things. So we honestly have less of a good idea of you know ecological impacts of infectious disease on wild populations. You know, we're just getting to the point with Ophidiomyces where it's like, yeah, this is wiping out these wild snakes. Because you know when we look at some other species, you know, for example, rhinoviruses, which you know do get basically anything that's not too hot. The same rhinovirus that's taking out frog populations and you know, frogs all get together in a big group and scream about sex. And so when they stop doing that, people notice. But it's taking out box turtles, you know, and the exact same rhinovirus that's taking out frogs is taking out box turtles. And they, unless someone's doing a box turtle survey, nobody notices they're gone. You know, so it's unfortunate, but we don't have a lot of the data points on a lot of the wild populations that we need, and they're going to be gone before anybody does it. You know.
So a former student of mine was one of the first people to really notice the rhinovirus issue. He was studying the ecology of box turtles, and all of his box turtles were becoming super light and dying. But anyways, yeah. The rhinovirus also infects snakes, and is it an issue for them if it does?
It does infect snakes. Do I have any data on wild population? No, we've seen it in captive snakes. Right. You know, do I expect it infects wild snakes? Yeah, I do. But do I have any idea what it's doing to wild populations right now? No, I don't. I am very concerned about it because it makes a lot of sense that it would be, but the data isn't there.
Yeah. So is that a kind of a common thing across snake disease where we know more about it in captivity? Would you suspect on average that a lot of these diseases are having a higher impact in the wild than we even recognize? We just don't.
Yeah. Especially with, you know, human impacts on habitats, you know, we're, you know, placing nutritional and housing stresses on these species, you know, as well as, you know, changing the temperatures that they live at and running them over with cars. So a disease is just, you know, one more ecological, you know, straw on the camel's back, and all of these things are, you know, how big of a straw is that? I don't know. It could be maybe it's a big oak log, and maybe it's just a straw. But all of these things combined together are certainly going to have major impacts on wild populations.
Yeah, and as you know, we've had a disease issue with indigo snakes, and we in captivity, and we knew almost nothing about the disease in the wild, and so we're trying to figure some of that out now. But so I'm going to transition here. I've kept you for an hour, but I do want to just take a couple moments and dive into a particular snake disease. And I would love to talk about snake fungal disease, but as I mentioned before we started recording, I have a whole podcast coming up very soon on snake disease with both of our colleagues. So I don't think we need to go into great depth there, although that's a fascinating subject. But again, we'll talk about it more. You've also worked on this sunshine virus that some people have heard about, and I've seen some press around that and your work. But maybe there's something else. I guess I would love, is there a particular disease that you think is very interesting? They're probably all interesting to some degree, but very interesting and would be very interesting to our audience, say, because of how prevalent it is, because of current topics, whatever it might be. That might be sunshine or that might be something else. I'm just curious what you think would be a good snake disease for us to dive a little bit into.
Well, I think one of the challenges with sunshine virus is we're looking, we're still early in the stages of that. We've found that in Australian pythons, and we've just found some in rattlesnakes in North America. But being able to tell everyone things that are going to impact their collection is probably less important than, for example, something like the nidoviruses, which is, the nidovirales is a family to which the coronaviruses belong. So that's or a order to which the coronaviruses belong. So that's been a topical subject for sure. And we're seeing, the leading cause of like any ball python die-off we're seeing these days is usually ball python nidovirus 1. There is huge diversity to these. We just found one yesterday in a bull snake that looks like a fairly divergent new species. And we're figuring out there are nidoviruses that are present. Steve Tillis is doing his PhD on looking at some of the nidoviruses in the Burmese pythons that have been released down into the Everglades. They are relatively good at jumping hosts and they're definitely the leading cause of death in captive ball pythons these days.
So how does a nidovirus, am I pronouncing that correctly?
And
so how does a nidovirus impact a ball python? I guess actually let's back up and let's go through the cycle. You talked about hosts. Does it need to go to some other type of animal before it, infects a ball python?
No, yeah. most in general, viruses tend to that there's nothing about a life cycle that would require an intermediate host unless it's something that's spread by, for example, a mosquito or something like that. Then it needs to be able to infect mosquito cells too. But most viruses are going to get a given host. The big question with any given virus is how specific is it to that host? So with the Sidewinder sunshine virus, we're seeing it looks like it doesn't even infect other rattlesnakes. So far, we've had other exposed rattlesnakes, and only the Sidewinder seem to be getting in it and dying. Whereas something like rhinovirus that we're talking about, the same virus is infecting frogs and snakes and sturgeon and box turtles. So that's got a huge wide host range. And it is you could argue it's a better generalist, from an ecological standpoint. That's something I try and figure out pretty early is, what is the host range that we're seeing with this? And for some animals, that can actually be a significant advantage, like herpes viruses of humans. The cold sore virus, human herpes virus 1, is, greater than 98% of people are infected. It'd probably go up from there, but no one ever lets me do trigeminal nerve root biopsies out of their face. so probably the other 2% are likely to be infected too. But so we're running around with that. Very few of us at any given point even have a cold sore. And we've developed, these social behaviors, kissing that it gets passed on and it gets a free ride around for 70 years now. And that's great. But if someone goes making out with a marmoset, which happens more than it really should, then that marmoset comes in and it's got encephalitis and hepatitis and it's dead in 72 hours or, you know, or so. And or a gibbon or a red or a black and white rough lemur, you know, all of these animals have major issues with this human herpes virus. Now, if you're a human population, you're competing with these other primates for that. Running around with this virus is not a selective disadvantage. It's, you know, it causes some disease in like neonates and things like that that can be serious. But overall, if you're competing with things and it's taking out your competitors, that's a selective advantage to be running around with it. The common pigeon herpes virus kills off hawks and owls and falcons, you know, and so it's a big advantage for them to be running around. So it's all about ecological context as to what this implies, you know.
Well, back to the nidovirus, that is all very interesting when you're talking about the pigeons and all that. But back to the nidoviruses. So two questions, how do they move from one host to another, say one ball python to another? Is it a respiratory thing? Are they shedding?
Yeah, it appears to be primarily transmitted respiratorily, you know. And again, we don't have good data on, you know, obviously, you know, there's a rather famous nidovirus floating around right now that's definitely aerosol transmitted and why we're all wearing masks. So that's a concern. It may be direct aerosol transmission. We don't have solid data yet as to whether we have aerosol-borne transmission or whether it's direct contact with fluids.
And how does it impact ball pythons? How is it killing them? Is it a respiratory thing? They're getting some form of like a pneumonia or something?
They get a pneumonia. They get stomatitis and esophagitis too, for that matter. It also is immunosuppressive, so they get other secondary diseases, and it, you know, it can take a while. I mean, some animals can linger on for a year or two with it, it's far and away the worst disease of ball pythons that we're aware of right now, and it's having major impacts because it seems to be blasted through the population before anyone knew what had happened,
Do we find it in the wild in the native range of the ball python?
I would love to survey that. We have not done that yet.
that would be a fun one.
Yeah.
Good field expedition.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Well, I appreciate it. And let's imagine that we are sitting around a campfire, maybe up on the coast of Maine, and having a couple cold beverages and we're just talking about all these things and you know, snakes and diseases and raptors and all of these great things. And I ask you I want to hear one of your best snake stories. What would you tell me?
Well, it's an infectious disease one.
Perfect.
So Borna viruses are – Borna is a town in Germany. And back in the 1700s, they had this encephalitis outbreak. So it was killing off horses and sheep, and so we've known about this disease for quite a while, and we hadn't found a lot of diversity to it. Later on, we figured out it was causing this disease in cats. It's actually associated with schizophrenia in humans, which is kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. And we just didn't know where they're coming from. And it was this group, and they're in the same order as the filovirus is where Ebola is, and the paramyxovirus is, you know, where measles and canine distemper are, and the rhabdovirus is where rabies is. So its cousins are some of the biggest badasses in virology. And we didn't know what the diversity was. And the other weird thing about these is that most RNA viruses, all your ribosomes or stuff are out in the cytoplasm. So that's usually where most RNA viruses hang out, and all your DNA is in the nucleus, and that's where most DNA viruses hang out. But this is weird because it's an RNA virus that hangs out in the nucleus. So it turns out that if you are RNA that hangs out in the nucleus, another thing that's happened a lot, if you look at a human genome, you might think it's mostly human protein genes, right? And about 1% of your genome codes for human proteins. But one thing that we've done a lot is there's a kind of virus called a retrovirus, which is where HIV sits. And that is a virus that starts out as RNA, goes backwards and makes DNA, and gets plugged into a genome. So it turns out that's happened a lot. And about 9% of your genome is retrovirus in origin. So you are literally about 9 times as much retrovirus as you are people. And so we've got lots of retroviruses. And if your RNA and you make it into a genome, it gets reverse transcribed and gets plugged in. So it turns out that 13-line ground squirrels have had a bit of retrovirus, has had a bit of bornavirus RNA that got reverse transcribed and plugged into their genome, and they're making this bornavirus protein. And you, that making that bornavirus protein seems to make them not susceptible to bornavirus disease. It protects them. When a new bornavirus infects it, it just doesn't function because there's this other protein there. So we're looking at these, and then my friend Tim Hyman from Australia, who's a great virologist at Murdoch, he's like, I've got this, I think it's a bornavirus from these carpet pythons, and we want to take a look at that. So man, I was really excited about it. Tim's a great guy. So we look at it, and it's a brand new bornavirus. And you know, you look at what's known about the other ones, and there's some in parrots that we found. And this thing was not really much like the other ones. It looks like it's a whole new genus in the bornaviruses. And I'm looking at what all its relatives are. And none of the relatives are wild viruses. They're all remnants left in genomes of other animals, and they're all only in the mammals. And I know this thing can kill it killed the carpet pythons pretty good. So it's capable of killing reptiles, and then certainly we've seen, you know, the other group of bornaviruses is a proventricular dilatation disease of macaws is a bornavirus as well in the previously known group. So I'm concerned about what it can do to reptiles. So I take a look at this, and all of the other things are sort of these fossil remnants in the genome. And they're all in mammals, and I'm looking at them and I look at how they're related, and all of the whale ones form a group, and all of the primate ones form a group, and all of the carnivore ones form a group. And I look at where they're plugged in, and it's plugged in the exact same place in a marmoset genome and a human genome. And it looks, the only way that makes sense is if they got plugged back into the common ancestor. And so I look at where all these things are sharing a common ancestor, where they got plugged in, and it goes back about 70 million years is when it got plugged in. And that's sort of an interesting time point from a geological thing, because we had the end of the dinosaurs was about 66 to 68 million years ago. So if you look previously at life on Earth, you know, we decide Carboniferous, you know, let's get up out of this water and go try being dry land things. And some of us go and become amphibians, and everyone else becomes an amniote. And, you know, so maybe 450 million years ago or so. And then the Carboniferous comes, and there's high oxygen levels, and we lay down, you know, all this trees grow to like 100 feet tall, and we lay down carbon layers that we're still blowing up mountains in West Virginia to get the coal out of. And by the time the Permian comes around, you know, we've gotten good at it. And but the things running around in Pangaea are in the therapsid group, which is therapsids. The only surviving ones are the mammals. The sauropsids are the reptiles, right? And the sauropsids are not the big dominant things. So the big dominant things running around are us. And we've got kidneys that are really expensive to run and require a whole bunch of energy. And we've got lungs that are not very efficient compared to like a bird lung or a crocodilian lung or even a monitor lung. So what happens 245 million years ago, there's a massive volcanic eruption and there's a huge CO2 dump. And all the CO2 gets dumped out and the oceans absorb it. And the pH of the oceans drops to the point where the reformers can't do the bryozoans, not corals back then, can't do it. And the marine ecosystems just collapse because all the reefs are taken out. So that goes, but the oceans can't absorb everything. So a lot of it stayed in the atmosphere, and the average temperature at the equator 245 million years ago was about 40 degrees Celsius, which is, you know, 110 hot. And so if that's your mean temperature, it's hitting 60 degrees Celsius on a regular basis. at the equator. And it turns out what happens to vertebrates do when that happens is they become cooked. So we lost, that's the biggest die off in the geological record. And we lost about 95% of species. And it wasn't even, you know, the things that survived were polar. But the mammals who have these much less efficient kidneys, or the thoracics, I should say, have much, much less efficient kidneys, much less efficient lungs, kind of died off. And that was the beginning of the age of reptiles, the Mesozoic. And the reptiles stepped in and took over because they have these lungs and kidneys that are much better at dealing with these temperature changes that we were dealing with. And really, the mammal lineage almost disappeared. The only ones of us that survived were these little things that lived in tunnels for the next 100 million years. And, so we almost disappeared. Well, you get to the end of the age of dinosaurs, and everybody knows about, Luis Alvarez was the guy who discovered the iridium layer. He was a Nobel laureate in physics, and they, found good evidence that a meteor impact hit the Gulf of Mexico, and, everyone knows about the meteor impact at the, and that was about 66 million years ago. But one of the other things, Luis Alvarez was a brilliant physicist and clearly a very good paleontologist too, but he was kind of a testosterone-driven. He spent all of his time, his career after that, crushing anybody who had any alternative theories about the end of the dinosaurs. So there's really good work showing that the oceanic die-off occurred 2 million years before the meteor hit, and the sauropods, the long necks and long tails and great big, Diplodocus looking sorts of things, had disappeared about then too. And the sea level was much higher. It was about 23% higher, because what happened 68 million years ago is the Deccan Steppes erupted in India. And they, again, a massive volcanic eruption dumps out piles and piles of CO2, and it got really hot. And that's why the sea level was, there was 23% less land mass. So we have another event where we have a group of animals who are clearly better adapted to these climate change things, and mammals. And yet, who's sitting here doing a podcast now? It's a couple of mammals, Why is that happening? Why do we survive? I mean, granted, meteor hitting the planet is not insignificant. I'm not going to claim it isn't. But this is at least partially a climate change event. What gave us the selective advantage? Well, if you look at what happened right before this whole shit hit the fan, we all got bits of Bornavirus genes in our genomes, and we have kept them across all of the mammals. The penetrance was pretty much 100% when I look at our genomes. And so we know that with the other Bornaviruses, 13-line ground squirrels having a bit of that plugged in protects them against this. When infectious diseases are going to have the biggest population level impact is when shit is hitting the fan otherwise. And I think that a climate change event, meteor hitting your planet, counts. So the selective advantage we may have had as mammals coming back after the end Cretaceous extinction that took out the big dinosaurs may have been that we were protected against this Bornavirus that we know is capable of killing reptiles. Huh. So that's my favorite. That's my favorite snake story.
Wow, that's most people, are walking through the woods and saw this amazing animal. But I like how you pull together, evolution, geology. Anyways, that was great. Thank you. I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. How can people learn more about you? What you're doing, maybe follow, something, your career going forward.
I'm at the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine. A good place for people to look for reliable medical literature is there's the PubMed website. You can look for that and search for authors and find peer reviewed literature. And that way the crap you're reading from stuff at least has been through a couple of peer reviewers so that hopefully it filters out some of my bullshit. You can take a look at the UF website. I'm available by email.
That sounds good. Well, thanks again, Jim.
All right.
And I just want to thank our audience and tell everybody that snakes are animals too. Privilege. See you. one in the wild.